I'm Paul Hanrahan, living here in Tralee for the last half century or so, and loving it.
Mm-hmm. Paul, what brought you to Tralee?
CIA, I came on the bus. And on a return ticket, which I still have the other part to use, so I have my get-out clause, but 50 years later, I don't know if it's still valid. One of the main reasons I came down here, I had some friends down here who were Baha'is, and I came down to join them for the weekend, and I'm still here.
Mm-hmm. And what is it that you loved about Kerry?
Oh, what isn't to love about Kerry? Tralee's a great place to live in because you have pretty much everything you need that you get from a town or city, and yet you're within minutes of Ballyseedy Woods or Banna Beach, and it's really the best of both worlds, you know, as far as I'm concerned. And I'd lived in London so for quite a time, and I'd travelled around quite a bit around the world on that, and I wouldn't like to live anywhere else.
Mm-hmm, yeah, and you obviously, you know, you took opportunities here in Tralee and opening a few businesses, so tell us a bit about that.
Okay. At first, I had a leather workshop down in a place called Friary Lane, which is in an old building, which is a Tralee gas supplies up from the Garda station. I think the building goes back to the 1600s. And we had a workshop up there and at the back of it, a couple of floors up. And you had all these wooden beams in the ceiling and on the floor. And this wasn't the restoration work. This was as it was for hundreds of years. So that was the first business to set up. And I remember I arrived in Tralee with a bag of leather, a kit of tools and £70 and a return bus ticket. And thought I need to find a room to live in, and I need to find a workroom to work in. And of course, you take one look at me at the time, you wouldn't leave me inside the door. You know? And but I went into a guy called Eddie Barrett in Norths, and he said, "Oh, I know a place that might suit you." And he brought me up to Oak Park and showed me this beautiful bungalow beside O'Donoghue's shop. He said, "You could use this. You could work in that room there." And oh yeah, and it was cheaper than what I was paying, so I got off to a really good start in Tralee.
Yeah, that sounds really good.
It's, there was a small Baha'i community here which I've been connected with since my early 20s, and a lot of musicians, I played music over the years, joined different bands, and people like late Paddy Malone and John Brown, and Metro and RPM, some of the older people might remember from the Abbey Inn, places mm-hmm. like that. I also played with a band called Staggerlee for a few years, and we played in Tralee for a long time, and then went off around the country.
And what did you play?
I played a saxophone and flute. Yeah.
Wow.
And in Staggerlee, we used to do mainly kind of funk and soul music. Mm-hmm. And we used to play in the Abbey Inn and the Brogue mainly. You know, three nights in each sometimes. And the festival, you'd be paying two or three times a day. But we used to get all these visiting, we built up quite a reputation. So all these top class musicians from Dublin would come down for the weekend. Mm. They'd be playing with horsips and things like that. They'd be familiar to some of the older people. And they'd come down and guest with us and join in because we were a real jamming band at the time.
You know? Yeah.
So that was great. I really enjoyed that.
You know? And how did that come about?
The band was started by a guy called Victor McCullough. The McCulloughs are great musicians, all of them. There's three or four brothers. And one of the brothers, Henry, used to play with Paul McCartney and Joe Cocker and things like that. He played in Woodstock with Joe Cocker.
Wow.
So his other brothers were here. And he started Staggerlee, and then he moved on. I took his place. He was a guitarist, but I wound up playing sax with him. And that pretty much, and Danny Lean, the late Danny Lean, like, was brilliant for the town in that he would give any band a chance, you know. Mm. And without that, a lot of bands wouldn't have got off the ground. And you talk to any of the bands around now from that time, with John Buggy and the Righteous Dudes or Francie Cullman, all of those, the Abbey Inn and the Brogue were there, give you the the start, and Francie Conway is still having number one hits around the world today.
Yeah. Have you any fond memories of your time of playing in either the Brogue or the Evian?
I have lots of fond memories. but there's one thing that stands out. We were just talking about it the other day. I remember when the festival, in the early days, and the American bands would come here, the Army band would come here. I think they would come over from Germany or something like that. And they were amazing musicians. And they would come up and jam with you. But the gigs would start maybe around 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And if your gig wasn't on till maybe nine, you know, there could be a couple of bands that played. You couldn't get in the door of the Abbey, so you'd have to bring your own PA and whatever. So it would you'd have to surf the PA down through the Abbey and to the stage. So it would be passed down from hand to hand over people, because you couldn't actually walk in with the stuff. They were the kind of crowds, and that was the buzz, and it was a brilliant atmosphere. Yeah.
Wow.
But anyway, there were different times.
Definitely, I suppose. Yeah, and sure, look at the Abbey now, unfortunately.
Yeah, it was of its time as well, you know. And but played lots of other music as well, you know, but that's some of the stuff that comes to mind.
So obviously, you have a big love for music. So is that why you took over the music shop in the mall?
Well, that emerged I'm involved with a small charity called Action Lesotho. And it operates in a small, very small area in Lesotho, which is a landlocked small country in southern Africa. And we work with the poorest of the poor down there, mainly people who have been living with AIDS for a long time. And there's a substantial orphan problem down there, because in the 80s and 90s, Lesotho was the second or third highest on the planet with the AIDS virus. So, and the age group that was really hit were the mid-20s to late 30s. So a lot of parents with young families were wiped out. So the children, there isn't an orphan system. I mean, you're talking about over 150,000 orphans in a population of 2 million. So you're looking at, in Ireland, there would be 250,000 orphans or more. You know, and so they don't have an orphan system as such. So the extended family or the villages kind of look after them. So we work a lot with those, and you're dealing with things. When I say we're a small charity, we set up around 15 years ago, met the ambassador from Lesotho at the time, Manetti Ramadi, here in Tralee. Pure chance. I often think about how things happen in life. You know, people say, did you plan this? Did you plan that? Most things happen by accident. Most things, you just bump into somebody, and if you stayed on the bus to the next stop, your life would be different. You know, we just simple things. And it's pure chance that I actually met the ambassador, because maybe, you know, Conor Lenehan was going around the country at the time. He was visiting seven cities and towns, getting feedback from the public on how the Irish government should develop Irish aid in the future. And so I was invited to sit on the panel of experts. All the experts were from up the country. You had the editor of the Irish Times, you had ambassadors and people from Concern, things like that, CEO Concern. But I was invited because I was involved in a local group called CAID, which is Kerry Action and Development Education. We used to go into schools with stuff. And but on the day before it was on, it was Tuesday night, I got a call on the Monday from a senior civil servant saying, look, we've been to six other places, we know all the questions that are coming, they're nearly all the same at this stage, and you know, all the same suggestions, so there's no need for you to be on the panel. And I said, that's really good news for me, because it's a Man United playing tomorrow night in the European Cup, and I would really much prefer to be looking at that than Conor Lennon, with all due respect to the minister. And I said, but you didn't invite me. He said, aren't you Paul Hanrahan? I said, yeah. I said, you invited the chairman of CAID. I just happened to hold that position as chairman at this time. So the chairman of CAID will be there. Unfortunately, Paul Hanrahan won't be able to watch the match. So I'm there, I sat in the panel. And from that, then I met Minetti Romadi, the ambassador, and we met up the next morning, and they explained to her that Kerry was a kingdom and Lesotho was a kingdom and so forth. I knew very little about the kingdom of Kerry, to be perfectly honest.
Mm-hmm.
I was invited, just sidetrack, I was invited a few years later to go to Wales to this conference where the British government was calling all of the charities that work in Lesotho together, and we were the only one in Ireland, and so they thought, obviously think that Ireland was still part of Great Britain, and invited us over. So I went over, and as it happened, Prince Harry was there. He was a young fella, and so he came over to the stand, and I asked this girl to take a photograph there, a bit of publicity, you know, with the Charles. Not sure I wanted to be promoting the monarchy in Kerry, you know, but anyway, there it was, you know.
Picture opportunity.
You don't know, they have a real sense of humour, because she was taking the photograph, and she was really nervous because she was British and he was the monarch or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
So she was nervous. And she said, I'm sorry, you said you look stunned, she said. And he looked at her, he said, "And I'm not stoned." She said, "No, I didn't. He knew exactly what she said.
Aww.
She nearly clapped. But at that conference, there was this English, I think he was a professor or something or other, and he said, "Kerry," he said, "yeah, that's a Bronze Age kingdom, isn't it?" And went into all the details of how Kerry got its name as a kingdom.
That's very interesting, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know that.
Yeah, I know.
Okay. So we, going back to the story, met the ambassador and asked about Twinning the Kingdoms. So our original name of Action Lesotho is Twinning the Kingdoms.
Mm-hmm.
But there's all sorts of legal reasons in a country that has a monarch where you can't use kingdom in the title.
Of course. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, this has become a huge part of your life, Action Lesotho. So, I mean, when you first started it up, or when it first started to become a charity or a thing for you, what was going through your head?
You know, there's that old saying about you can't help everyone, but that's no reason for not helping someone. You know, that's always been part of the thing. I also believe that the world is one country and mankind is citizens, that there isn't, if a child is starving in the other part of the world, like Lesotho is 14,500 kilometres away, it's still a child starving unnecessarily. And if you can do something, and Action Lesotho is, we made a decision, like, and got great support in the local community, you know, from all sorts of, you know, from FOSS, from the Help Board, you know, they came in and we helped to get the thing off the ground. But we made a decision earlier on and stuck with it, that it would always be run by volunteers, that there would be no employed staff.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in making that decision, you're always going to be small. But it's a community project. And if you employ someone, it changes the nature of it, because your costs go right up. And you then have to have professional fundraising to, you know, it moves on to another level. And I think that's brilliant. You know, that, and I think big organizations like Concern, Goal, and so forth, I think they should be paying top wages to the best people coming out of the Smurfit School to get the most they can for the people they're helping.
Mm-hmm.
But we would be like the corner shop in comparison, say, to Dunn's or Tesco, if you know what I mean. You know, there's a role for the smaller community as well, because you know, RSA don't have any projects in Lesotho.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there's a role for the smaller community groups, and volunteerism in Ireland is such an integral part of what we are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if volunteers pulled back for 24 hours in Ireland, the country would just grind to a halt.
Yeah,
you know, I don't think it's fully appreciated how many community organisations depend on volunteers. So we were run completely by volunteers.
Yeah. Speaking of volunteers, you obviously have, you know, your pack of people that will help you. Why did they do it?
Why did they do it? I think it gives some meaning and purpose to their lives. You know, I think it's a natural thing for human beings to give. and, you know, and to have some empathy for others. Not everybody has it, because all sorts of things happen in people's background, especially in childhood, that twist them in some way or other, and they lose empathy for others. And you can see it emerging very early when they don't have empathy for small animals and things that start hurting. You can see this is an indicator that later on they're not going to have any empathy for humans. But most people live some kind of a normal life, and there's a natural instinct mm-hmm. in them to, they appreciate that they can put a meal on the table for their family, and they'd like to think that other families could have a meal as well. So yeah, that's simplifying it, but I think my own belief as a Baha'i is that we've twin natures. We have a physical nature and we have a spiritual nature, and you develop your spiritual qualities by taking any opportunity you can. And usually it's about doing something that's selfless. Almost impossible to do something selfless, because you'll get something back from it anyway. You know, mm-hmm. you empty water out of a jug, it'll be filled with air. You know, it's just, but at least you're emptying the water out of the jug, you know, mm-hmm. and you're not hoarding your resources when others have nothing.
For Action DeSoto for the next couple of months, what are you hoping to do?
Our main focus at the moment is that we're helping people living with AIDS. And so we have a humanitarian side where we give them food parcels for the month, because they get free medication. But if you don't have the proper nutrition with it, the medication can actually do more damage to the individual. So we set up this project where we help 40 families who are living with AIDS. And then we moved on to where we would help children who are going to school hungry. So we set up a breakfast club where they come in, 80 of them, for breakfast in the morning before going to school, and they come back afterwards for help with their schoolwork. And then we set up a creche for the very poor mothers. And so we had 22 kids coming in there from the age, you know, of 2 up to 5. But we found that when we were testing them there for their health, that their height and weight, and that half of them were coming to us with stunted growth or malnutrition. So then we thought the next step is we go to the families and find out if they have younger siblings. So we introduced a project that they finish breastfeeding at 6 months. That's the culture. You can be saying what you like, but in a culture there's a procedure, and they finish, and then very often the child isn't getting sufficient nutrition. Stunted growth cannot be turned after 2 years. You have that period between 6 months and 2 years to get the nutrition into the child. After that, it affects the growth and the brain and things like that. So the current program that we have 22 of these infants on this nutrition program. It's mainly peanut butter and long life milk. For us, it's one of the most expensive programs we run, because it costs us nearly €1 a day for each child. Out there, that's a lot. Mm-hmm. But we're hoping to bring that up to 40 from 22. We're up to 30. So, you know, we try to generate as much of our own income as we can, but we completely depend on support from the community financially as well. And the community, you know, the local community are generous. They've been very supportive to us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I suppose if anyone does want to support you or anything, they can visit Action DeSoto and make a few donations there?
Absolutely. You know, we are online, actiondesoto.ie, or contact email or through the shops or anything like that, you know. But it's not just funds that we look for. Like, because we have a bric-a-brac shop, we look for vintage stuff or any kitchenware or small furniture. And then we have a music shop where we have DVDs and videos and albums and old guitars and keyboards, you know. And they often find, for instance, people have a room where the child went off to college 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And half the stuff is still in there. And they don't want to throw it out. But now they realize they don't want the child to come back there either.
That's the whole sentimental value exactly. thing, which I can never understand.
Yeah. So, if they're clearing out, if they, we would, you know, if there's albums and musical instruments in there, we would love to get them, you know. So, and you can send a photograph to the child then, who's now probably living up in Dublin or whatever, and say, your room is gone once and for all, don't come back, you know, we cleared it out.
Very good.
And so we depend on the support community. That's what keeps us going, both volunteers and what they donate to us. So supporting our shops is supporting those kids as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And briefly before we do finish as well, we wanted to talk about the Garden of Contemplation.
Oh yeah, we've this is part of my Baha'i hat on. Mm-hmm. We have a Garden of Contemplation down at Padraig Pearse Park. It's the gate opposite, it's the small park, it's the one opposite Seamus Ó Tíre. You'd have the car park behind it, yeah. Mm-hmm. And down in the corner. And what it is, it was the 200th anniversary of the birth of Baha'u'llah. So we built this garden, it's donated to the public. And every couple of weeks we have 11 quotes in there that would come from different religions, philosophers, poets, and we change the quotes every couple of weeks. So there's regularly people come in, look through the quotes, take photographs.
And that's a nice gesture.
The idea is to plant some positive thoughts in the head for the day, basically, mm-hmm. you know. And there's, that's all it is, you know, and it's been there now 3 or 4 years, you know. It's probably the best kept secret and should no longer be a secret after this.
Well, we'll definitely all be, I usually go down to the park for my walk, for my lunch, but I'll be checking that out because in saying that, you know, it's lovely to read positive quotes because I think we fill our heads with so many negative things.
Yeah.
It's lovely to just be able to read something so short and simple but so positive as well.
This is it. And what it does really is that it gives your soul, your spirit, a connection with the greater stuff. Otherwise, you're just left with your physical mind and body struggling to keep, you know, food on the table, you know, who are we going to pay the bills in the next few months, what's going to happen to the world and that, you know. And we forget that we are ultimately for spiritual beings. We have to kind of remind ourselves of that every now and then. And that doesn't matter what religious belief you have. Mm-hmm. You find it's exactly the same. All religions pray to the same God. I often use the expression, you know, that we're all in different taxis going to the same concert.
Yeah, very, very true. Yeah, so. And on that note, Paul, we'll leave it there, but thank you so much. You've done so much for your community already and you should be so proud of everything that you've achieved so far.
Oh, the community has done so much for me. You have no idea how much gratitude I have for what Kerry has given me.